It was now about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour, while the sun's light failed. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And having said this, he breathed his last. Now when the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God, saying, "Certainly this man was innocent." And all the crowds that had assembled for this spectacle, when they saw what had taken place, returned home beating their breasts. And all his acquaintances and the women who had followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things.
Thanks, Erica. In January of this year, Washington, the city of Washington, remembered the anniversary of 30 years of the Erida, Florida crash. And what had happened was during an extraordinary period of freezing weather, the wings of the plane froze up, and soon after takeoff, it crashed into the Potomac River. 79 people were on board, but only six survived. And very soon after the crash, crowds gathered on the shore to see what was going on, and watched really in horror as they saw the rescue operation get underway and the helicopter trying to pull up those few surviving passengers from the freezing river. They saw one man who got hold of the winch, but then let go. And it seemed to everyone on the shore that he was just too weak to be able to let the winch haul himself out. The line went back up again another two times and down. Again he got hold of it, and again he let go. And by the time the chopper came back a third time, it was too late. And to the crowd it seemed all so helpless and tragic. But only later did, from the helicopter crew, did it transpire what actually happened. The reality that was that the man we'd been speaking of was a man named Arlen Williams. He was in fact quite able to save himself. But on those two occasions, as the winch came down, he had self-sacrificially handed on the winch to his fellow survivors who had been unable to reach it. And by the time they were all safe, the chopper came back, but he had drowned. It's a remarkable story of self-sacrifice, of a man who on first appearances looks unable to save himself, but who in reality was spurning rescue in order to save others. And in Luke's account here of Jesus' crucifixion, I think what we see is something very similar. To so many, as Jesus dies, he's just a pathetic fraud who can't even save himself. The reality, as we look a little bit deeper, is that here is a loving king who is all about saving others. The appearance, a pathetic fraud who couldn't save himself. If you were here on Sunday, you'll remember that we saw the crowds shouting vehemently, "Crucify, crucified," being stirred up by the religious leaders. We saw their madness in requesting the release of a condemned criminal in the place of Jesus. And now what we're seeing is the consequence of their decisions, that the drama really is at its climax. Their cries of "crucify" have become a reality, and Jesus hangs on the cross as they had so insistently demanded. And yet, their hatred for him still isn't appeased. So have a look at verse 35. The rulers scoff. "He saved others, let him save himself, if he's the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers are in on it as well. In verse 36, mocking him, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." Verse 38, "Even the sign they put above his head is designed to ridicule him. This is the king of the Jews." The criminal, verse 39, beside him, "Even the criminal shouts, 'Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us.'" And they're thinking, well, how funny, because this is Jesus who had talked about himself as a king, who talked about saving other people, and yet here he was himself pinned to a cross. And you can almost imagine the conversations going on in the crowd as they watch, some people saying, "Well, do you know what? We knew it all along. We knew it was fake. No, you didn't. Yeah, we did. Others being more honest, saying, well, do you know what? Honestly, at the beginning, I was taken in by him. But, you know, how wrong can you be? Stupid come to think of it now. After years of really being hounded by my dad, I finally got round to reading C.S. Lewis, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe from the Narnia series. It's a fantastic read. My Bible study group get a little illustration from The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe pretty much every week because I like it so much. If you haven't read it, it's a beautiful story, which is also an allegory of the Christian message. And in it, Lewis captures so well the kind of crowd's ironic mocking of Aslan, the king, the Christ figure, as he's being killed. Have a listen to this. A roar of mean laughter went up from the witch's followers as an ogre with a pair of shears came forward and squatted down by Aslan's head. Snip, snip, snip went the shears, and masses of curling gold began to fall to the ground. Then the ogre stood back, and the children, watching from their hiding place, could see the face of Aslan looking all small and different without its mane. The enemies also saw the different. Why, he's only a great cat after all, cried one. Is that what we were afraid of? Said another, and they surged round Aslan, jeering at him, saying things like, Puss, poor cat, how many mice have you caught today, cat? Would you like a saucer of milk? Likewise, Jesus isn't a king. He's a pathetic fraud who can't even save himself. That's what they thought. And their thinking is, well, real kings are powerful. Real kings don't just let themselves die. I'm a bit out of my depth when it comes to talking about history and kings and queens. But think through even the most famous kings and emperors in history, Napoleon, or Caesar Augustus, or Richard I. I read up on Richard I this week. Apparently, when he was just 16, he led a revolt against his own father. He led his own army, which is pretty powerful for a 16-year-old, I'd say. Alexander the Great ruled one of the largest empires in ancient history, undefeated in battle. Apparently, his reputation was such that he could make an entire city surrender without killing anyone. Such was his reputation for power and strength. Because they're thinking, well, kings are meant to be powerful and strong. Yet here is Jesus hung pathetically on a cross, the pretend king. He's been found out. How embarrassing. Well, I think this should serve really to straighten out our expectations. By which I mean, if we're Christians, then our king is one who died a humiliating death. We've got to remember that many people won't see past this. Just as he was mocked then, we shouldn't be surprised when people mock him now and call him a fake. I remember when I was younger on the rugby bus, one of the songs the boys used to sing was, Jesus can't do this, Jesus can't do that. And then the ironic refrain, Jesus saves, Jesus saves, Jesus saves. Really, they're singing the song of this crowd. We shouldn't be surprised. Jesus' death does make him look weak. Nor should we be surprised, I suppose, when we take the flak as his followers. We should expect it. The other evening I was watching an online debate between Richard Dawkins and the Christian scientist John Lennox on the question, hasn't science buried God? And in it, Dawkins really accuses Lennox of believing in the petty nonsense that is Jesus dying to save. Let's get our expectations right. Jesus will get mocked, and so will we, if we speak about his death as we should. Well, that's the appearance. But the reality that Luke presents us with is that here, rather, is a loving king who is all about saving others. We're on to our second point, if you're following on the sheets. The thing that the soldiers and the rulers and the criminal beside him all misunderstand is that Jesus is a king. In fact, he's the most powerful of kings. So what did we say? Richard I commanded his own army in revolt against his father, aged 16. That's impressive. But it's got nothing when compared to commanding a raging storm, stilling it with a word like King Jesus. Alexander the Great could make entire cities surrender without even having to kill a single person. Well, that's brilliant. But it's nothing when compared to raising people from the dead, like King Jesus did to the widow's son. And actually, when you look back across, back through Luke's Gospel, you see example again and again and again of this king's power. To the point where you're almost losing count of the number of miracles that Jesus does. You think, oh gosh, it's another healing. Tell me something new. But it puts it into perspective, doesn't it? Jesus is a king. Make no mistake about it. The most powerful of kings at that too. So to say that he couldn't save himself, well, it's just short-sighted. You see, just like it was with Arnold Williams, so it is here with Jesus. It wasn't that he couldn't save himself, but that he wouldn't save himself in order to save others. So have a look at verse 34. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And they cast lots to divide his garments. I wonder if you've ever been in a survival mode experience, a near-death experience, something like that. When I was a little bit younger, I did have one of these experiences. I was swimming with friends in the Lake District, and it was a classic case of my overestimating my ability. So I dived in. I realised that the lake was bigger, the water was colder, and I was a lot less fit than I imagined. And I got halfway across, and then I had this horrible moment where I realised that I wasn't going to make it. And at that moment, all I'm thinking is just keep going. You've got to keep going, slapping my hands in the water to keep on swimming. It's a horrible feeling. I got to about 20 metres from the shore and realised there that I wasn't going to make it myself. At that point, all I was thinking was get help. Make sure that your friends on the shore hear you, shouting at the top of my voice to get help. They thought I was joking and started throwing stones at me. which is slightly mean when they call you friends. But the point is, whenever you're in survival mode, all you are thinking about is getting to the shore. Eventually one friend came out and helped me in, thank goodness. All you think about is saving yourself. Of course it is. It's natural. Well, it's no exaggeration to say that this is Jesus' darkest hour, what with the excruciating pain so near to death. And yet he's single-minded, not on saving himself, but on saving others. I mean, it's remarkable. Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." His executioners are having a raffle to divide up his clothes, but Jesus is consumed just with thoughts of forgiveness. And actually, even to voice those thoughts would have been such a sacrifice. Crucifixion is suffocation, really. To get enough air in your lungs to speak, victims would have had to push themselves up on their nailed feet at the cost of excruciating pain. "Father, forgive them." No, the only thing on Jesus' mind and on his lips is saving others. It's a wonderful insight into Jesus' heart. But we see it also from this conversation with the criminal as well. If you were here on Sunday, we saw how the four gospel accounts are all true but have different emphases. And one of the tools in which we work out what is Luke's particular focus was to compare and contrast his account with the other gospel accounts to see what stands out. And in recounting the crucifixion, Matthew and Mark, they go really big on the significance of the darkness from 12 to 3 and on this the curtain in the temple being torn in two. And Luke records these things as well, but he doesn't give them the same airtime. Actually, Luke's focus seems to be rather on this wonderful exchange between Jesus and this criminal. It's something only he records. So have a look at verse 39. "One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, 'Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us.' But the other rebuked him, saying, 'Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong.' And he said, 'Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.' And he said to him, 'Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise.'" Luke doesn't tell us what this man has done, what his crime is. But I think we can assume that it's pretty serious. We've got to remember the type of criminals that the Romans executed. We think back to last week of Barabbas, a rioter and a murderer. Matthew tells us in his account this guy is a thief. But don't think shoplifter. If he's on death row, it's serious. And actually, we saw in verse 41, this man himself admits that crucifixion is a fair punishment for his crimes, which makes our minds race to think what he must have done. I think of the guy in the news just yesterday, arrested for armed robbery in Shropshire. He was one of three masked gunmen. He broke into a couple's home, dragged the couple upstairs to their bedroom, tied them, beat them up, and held them at gunpoint whilst he ransacked their house. They took 50 grand's worth of stuff and their cars. His victims, a man and his fiancée, said they were absolutely terrified and thought that they were going to be killed. Well, I think this is the type of man that we've got here. He's a criminal facing the death sentence. And we think, well, surely Jesus is going to have absolutely nothing to do with him. You've seen in Luke's account again and again how Luke underlines Jesus' innocence. We saw it last week. And yet this guy couldn't be more guilty. They are absolute polar opposites. And yet look at this remarkable conversation. One criminal joins in with a patronizing rabble, but this other one recognizes something special about Jesus. Essentially he's saying, look, shut up. Don't you fear God? We're guilty. We're getting what we deserve, but this man's innocent. Everyone else had been laughing at the fact that Jesus called himself a king. But this man saw through it. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. He sees the reality. He knows Jesus is king. And we might think, well, you know, he's a thief. He's a criminal with a reputation like his. Maybe he's just hedging his bets. Maybe he's got nothing to lose. But I don't think that's the case at all. So we spoke earlier of the effort and pain even to speak on the cross. That's true for this guy as well. You only speak if you feel absolutely compelled to. And in any case, Jesus is the perfect judge of character. He knows if someone's trying to try it on with him. Now this guy is genuine. He laments his crime. If he could turn back the time, he would. He admits his guilt, he accepts his punishment, he knows it's fair. And he asks for mercy. Jesus, remember me. And amazingly, Jesus responds to this most unlikely of converts with acceptance and forgiveness. Truly, I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise. It's such a poignant moment. I like to imagine this guy later on that evening arriving up in paradise, absolutely mesmerized by what he sees, but at the same time probably feeling quite awkward and insecure. He speaks to one of the angels to say, look, I met the king this afternoon. He was on the cross next to me, but to be honest, I don't think I should be here. I'm a crook. I don't deserve it. Only for the angel to reply, no, make yourself at home. The king's paid for your crimes. You belong here. He sees Jesus come towards him again, feeling sheepish, thinking to himself, will he remember me? Is he going to ask me to leave? Only for Jesus to embrace him. Good to see you, friend. What a day. What a king. All about saving others. Well, I think it's wonderful, kind of heartwarming stuff, giving us an insight into Jesus' heart on that first Good Friday. What does it mean for us now? I guess there's a couple of things for us to take away and think about over the weekend. I think first, to the person who maybe isn't a Christian, I think Luke is saying, turn. Look, recognize Jesus as King, confident he will forgive you, confident of a place in his kingdom. It's not about good or bad. This guy couldn't be worse. It's about recognizing our guilt and asking for Jesus' forgiveness, confident he will not turn us away. But secondly, I guess to those of us who are Christians, one of the things that Luke is doing is assuring us that Jesus' forgiveness extends even to the most hideous of our crimes. I think there are times in the Christian life when we perhaps see it and feel it more acutely, what we're really like underneath it all. Those times are good, it's being honest, it's being self-aware. But at those times, I guess we can be very vulnerable because we struggle to believe that we can really be forgiven. Will I really be welcomed into heaven? And Luke is saying here, well, if we recognise Jesus as King and plead mercy like this thief, then yes, we can be confident. He says to the criminal, today you'll be with me in paradise. There are no buts or maybes. There's no purgatory. There's no we'll wait and see to see if there's any space left. There's no you'll have to smarten up a bit first. This guy can't do anything. He's pinned on a cross. And yet for him it's immediate and complete pardon. And one of Luke's purpose of including this is to reassure us, even with a history like this, we are not beyond Jesus' forgiveness if we would only turn and ask for it. A pathetic fraud? No. A loving king who is all about saving others. Well, as we finish, why not let's just take a minute by ourselves. Kev will come up in a minute and introduce the next song. A minute just to reflect on this, our King.